Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm delighted you've joined me for a special salute. Every year on April 22nd, over a billion people in 190 countries take action for Earth Day. This year's global theme is green cities. As the world's population migrates to cities, and as the bleak reality of climate change becomes increasingly clear, the need to create sustainable communities is more important than ever. So, a literary salute to Mother Earth is our agenda for today. We'll preview fiction and nonfiction titles that spotlight key issues. But take heart, it's not all gloom and doom. Nothing is more powerful than the collective action of a billion people. Let's take action now as we turn to page one of the book report. And now to begin the book report, some Earth Day history. On Earth Day 1970, 20 million Americans displayed their commitment to a clean environment. It was called the largest demonstration in human history, and it permanently changed the nation's political agenda. The seemingly simple idea, a day set aside to focus on protecting our natural environment, was the brainchild of U.S. Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin. It accomplished far beyond his expectations, his lifelong goal of putting the environment onto the nation's and the world's political agendas. Today we'll spotlight his story with Bill Christopherson's The Man from Clear Lake, Earth Day founder Senator Gaylord Nelson. Nelson ranks as one of history's leading environmentalists. He also played a major role as an early outspoken opponent of the Vietnam War, and as a Senate insider was a key player in civil rights, poverty, civil liberties, and consumer protection issues. The life of Nelson, a small-town boy who learned his values and progressive political principles at an early age, is woven through the political history of the 20th century. David Henry narrates.
There were plenty of theatrics, dramatic gestures, and attention-getting stunts. So many students in Omaha, Nebraska, wore gas masks that the supply ran out. Indian sitar music greeted the dawn over Lake Mendota at the University of Wisconsin, accompanied by an apology to God. In San Francisco, environmental vigilantes dumped oil into a reflecting pool at Standard Oil Company offices to protest oil spills. At Boston's Logan Airport, a group of young people was arrested for blocking a corridor to protest the development of a supersonic transport. A group in Denver gave the Atomic Energy Commission an award, Environmental Rapist of the Year. Old automobiles were pounded, demolished, disassembled, and buried. School children and adults alike collected trash and litter from roadsides, parks, streams, and lakes. In Ohio, students put, "This is a polluter," stickers on autos. And at Iowa State and Syracuse universities, students blocked autos from coming onto the campus. In Tacoma, Washington, 100 students rode down a freeway on horseback to protest auto emissions. In Cleveland, 1,000 students filled garbage trucks with trash. In Appalachia, students buried a trash-filled casket. California students cut up their oil company credit cards. In Coral Gables, Florida, a demonstrator paraded with dead fish and a dead octopus in front of a power plant. But the real focus was the schools. The National Education Association estimated that 10 million public school children took part in Earth Day programs. Earth Day organizers said 2,000 colleges and 10,000 grade and high schools participated. In Clear Lake, Wisconsin, Gaylord Nelson's hometown, junior and senior high school students observed Earth Day at a school assembly with speeches, songs, and skits, then cleaned up more than 250 bags full of litter from the streets and highways in and around the village. A photo of young demonstrators with picket signs ran on page one of the Clear Lake Star the next week. Many businesses put on their best faces and joined the call for a cleaner earth. In New York, Consolidated Edison supplied the rakes and shovels that school children used to clean up Union Square and provided an electrically powered bus to take Mayor Lindsay around the city. Scott Paper, Texas Gulf Sulphur, Sun Oil, Rex Chain Belt, and other companies used the occasion to announce projects to clean up or control pollution. Continental Oil introduced four new cleaner gasolines. Alcoa ran newspaper ads touting a new anti-pollution process at its plants. And Republic Steel sent 25 company executives to speak at high schools and colleges. The business participation drew a mixed reaction. Organizers said some companies spent more money on advertising their support of Earth Day than on Earth Day itself. General Electric stockholders meeting in Minneapolis were greeted outside by a protester dressed as the Grim Reaper, and later at the meeting were confronted by a student leader demanding that the company refuse war contracts and instead use its influence to channel government expenditures into protecting the environment. The nation's news media were uncertain of what to make of Earth Day. Newsweek was bemused and somewhat dismissive, calling Earth Day a bizarre nationwide rain dance and the nation's biggest street festival since the Japanese surrendered in 1945. Time said the day had aspects of a secular, almost pagan holiday. The question, Newsweek said, was whether the whole uprising represented a giant step forward for contaminated Earthmen or just a springtime skip-along. The event lacked the passion of anti-war and civil rights movements, Newsweek said, and the issues were so unfocused as to give rise to the kind of nearly unanimous blather usually reserved for the flag. Time said the real question was whether the movement was a fad or could sustain the interest and commitment it would take to bring about real change. Was it all a passing fancy? The New York Times asked in a morning after editorial, then answered its own question. We think not. Conservation is a cause whose time has come because life is running out. Man must stop pollution and conserve his resources, not merely to enhance existence, but to save the race from intolerable deterioration and possible extinction.
That was The Man from Clear Lake by Bill Christofferson. The Book Report presents Gary Hansen's Wet Desert, an environmental thriller that offers action and plenty to think about. Grant Stevens is a mid-level manager for the Bureau of Reclamation, a guy who only wanted to build dams. He never imagined he'd be swept into a desperate race against an environmental terrorist bent on restoring the Colorado River by blowing up the dams. Left temporarily in charge of the Bureau, Grant must react when the first dam is attacked. He faces the unthinkable task of mitigating the massive flood roaring down the Colorado. The flood will eventually threaten the mighty Hoover Dam, and if Hoover fails, the other dams downstream will fall like dominoes. Working with the FBI, Grant uses his engineering skills, river knowledge, and plenty of gut instinct in an attempt to outmaneuver the terrorist. The chase leads downstream to the Gulf of California in a cat-and-mouse game where the stakes are high and the potential for destruction is enormous. Greg Dem narrates.
He checked the guard shack one more time and, seeing nothing, bent down to set the timer. He'd planned on 10 minutes, scripting the whole scenario, but his subconscious kept nagging him to do 15. He compromised at 12. He pressed the button, and a small red light illuminated while the digital timer started counting down from 12. He immediately stood and walked around the truck. As he came around the back, he tripped on something. He looked down and saw the wires. Damn. With the timer still running, he quickly checked the connections between the five holes, making sure all five sets of wires were still connected. They looked fine. He jumped in the truck, hoping it would start. Thankfully, it did, and he drove back along the dike. It took all his self-control to resist the urge to floor it and speed down the hill. When he finally pulled up to the roadblock, he could feel the hair standing up on the back of his neck. The bureau guard stepped over to talk. The man had hoped to get waved through. "What'd you find out?" the guard said, looking in the back of the truck.
"Dry as a bone, just as I expected."
This seemed to relieve the guard. "I guess that's good news. This dam's likely to get a good workout for the next couple days with all the water headed our way." The skinny man had a hard time not rushing his words.
"Yeah, you know it."
"So you think it'll hold?" asked the guard. For some reason, the question caught him off guard. No, it wasn't going to hold. It would explode in 8.5 minutes and counting. For a moment, his brain told him to warn the guy, tell him to get away as fast as he could, to not look back. He felt like screaming.
"There's a bomb, you idiot! It's going to blow! Get out of here!"
But he didn't. Instead, he responded in a calm, clear voice that surprised even him.
Yeah, it'll hold. No problem. But there's going to be a ton of water barreling out of those spillways.
Unbelievable, said the guard, looking over at the dam itself. Unbelievable.
The skinny man nodded.
You said it. Things are going to get a little crazy around here.
The guard smiled and stepped back, an unspoken signal that he was free to leave.
That was Wet Desert by Gary Hansen. Author Elizabeth Colbert has been all over the talk show circuit with her best-selling title, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. So the Book Report suspects you'd like to know a bit more about it. Over the last half a billion years, there have been five mass extinctions, where the diversity of life on Earth suddenly and dramatically contracted. Scientists around the world are currently monitoring the sixth extinction, predicted to be the most devastating event since the asteroid impact that wiped out the dinosaurs. This time around, the cataclysm is us. Colbert draws on the work of researchers in half a dozen disciplines, accompanying many of them into the field. Geologists who study deep ocean cores, botanists who follow the tree line as it climbs the Andes, and marine biologists who dive off the Great Barrier Reef. Colbert introduces us to a dozen species, some already gone, others facing extinction, including the Panamanian golden frog, staghorn coral, and the Sumatran rhino. Through these stories, Colbert provides a moving account of the disappearances occurring all around us. The sixth extinction compels us to rethink the fundamental question of what it means to be human. Readers, consider this, though. In reviews of the audio edition, listeners are universal in their disappointment with Anne Twomey's narration. This may be a title to choose in print.
Beginnings, it said, are apt to be shadowy. So it is with this story, which starts with the emergence of a new species maybe 200,000 years ago. The species does not yet have a name, nothing does, but it has the capacity to name things. As with any young species, this one's position is precarious. Its numbers are small and its range restricted to a slice of eastern Africa. Slowly, its population grows, but quite possibly then it contracts again, some would claim nearly fatally, to just a few thousand pairs. The members of the species are not particularly swift or strong or fertile. They are, however, singularly resourceful. Gradually, they push into regions with different climates, different predators, and different prey. None of the usual constraints of habitat or geography seem to check them. They cross rivers, plateaus, mountain ranges. In coastal regions, they gather shellfish. Farther inland, they hunt mammals. Everywhere they settle, they adapt and innovate. On reaching Europe, they encounter creatures very much like themselves, but stockier and probably brawnier, who have been living on the continent far longer. They interbreed with these creatures and then, by one means or another, kill them off. The end of this affair will turn out to be exemplary. As the species expands its range, it crosses paths with animals twice, 10, and even 20 times its size. Huge cats, towering bears, turtles as big as elephants, sloths that stand 15 feet tall. These species are more powerful and often fiercer, but they are slow to breed and are wiped out. Although a land animal, our species, ever inventive, crosses the sea. It reaches islands inhabited by evolution's outliers, birds that lay foot-long eggs, pig-sized hippos, giant skinks. Accustomed to isolation, these creatures are ill-equipped to deal with the newcomers or their fellow travelers, mostly rats. Many of them, too, succumb. The process continues in fits and starts for thousands of years until the species, no longer so new, has spread to practically every corner of the globe. At this point, several things happen more or less at once that allow Homo sapiens, as it has come to call itself, to reproduce at an unprecedented rate. In a single century, the population doubles, then it doubles again, and then again. Vast forests are raised. Humans do this deliberately in order to feed themselves. Less deliberately, they shift organisms from one continent to another, reassembling the biosphere. Meanwhile, an even stranger and more radical transformation is underway. Having discovered subterranean reserves of energy, humans begin to change the composition of the atmosphere. This, in turn, alters the climate and the chemistry of the oceans. Some plants and animals adjust by moving. They climb mountains and migrate toward the poles. But a great many, at first hundreds, then thousands, and finally perhaps millions, find themselves marooned. Extinction rates soar, and the texture of life changes. No creature has ever altered life on the planet in this way before, and yet other comparable events have occurred. Very, very occasionally in the distant past, the planet has undergone change so wrenching that the diversity of life has plummeted. Five of these ancient events were catastrophic enough that they're put in their own category, the so-called Big Five. In what seems like a fantastic coincidence, but is probably no coincidence at all, the history of these events is recovered just as people come to realize that they are causing another one. When it is still too early to say whether it will reach the proportions of the Big Five, it becomes known as the Sixth Extinction. The story of the Sixth Extinction, at least as I've chosen to tell it, comes in 13 chapters. Each tracks a species that's in some way emblematic. The American mastodon, the great auk, an ammonite that disappeared at the end of the Cretaceous alongside the dinosaurs. The creatures in the early chapters are already gone, and this part of the book is mostly concerned with the great extinctions of the past and the twisting history of their discovery, starting with the work of the French naturalist Georges Cuvier.
We've just heard The Sixth Extinction by Elizabeth Colbert. Larry Budmeier describes himself as a recovering journalist and foundationist, a true Floridian, and a come-here Virginian. Meyer is a former editor and executive at my alma mater, the Miami Herald, and was a vice president and secretary of the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. He's a graduate of the Missouri School of Journalism and Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He and his wife live in Rappahannock County, Virginia, and Miami. Today, we'll speak with him about his first novel, Mother Fracker. Welcome, Larry Bud, and thanks for joining us today on the Book Report.
Thanks, Elaine.
Well, you were trained as a journalist, so why this foray into fiction?
Well, I loved working as a journalist, the pursuit of facts and the truth. I did that for 20 years. I transitioned to work for a major foundation where the communications work was more about explaining and describing an agenda with purpose. And for a foundation, it's a good purpose. So we did good work. But it was different. It was, you know, propaganda. And the work that I did was the public relations work. People call that flacking, and I accept that as well. So as I moved on to a new chapter writing fiction, I drew on both of those disciplines, they've been very beneficial backgrounds for new work in fiction. And in short form, I described that transition going from fact to flack to frack.
Well, that's a very good progression. Now, your main character is Tippecanoe Tyler, a retired environmental journalist. Can we assume he's based on you?
No, and thanks for asking. That is a widespread assumption, but while my career was in journalism and while I set Tip Tyler as an environmental journalist in the Miami Herald newsroom where I did work, I was an editor and an executive, and I worked with other reporters, but was never a reporter at the Herald, nor was environmental journalism necessarily my strength. I, as I invented the character Tip Tyler, I wanted to combine my interests in the environment and my background in journalism into a protagonist who had a background in environmental journalism.
For those of us who are a little fuzzy about it, what is fracking exactly and why is it so controversial?
Fracking is a short-term word for hydraulic fracturing, a technique that's been used for 60 years by the oil and gas industry. It's newly popular because new technology, improved technology, allows oil drillers and gas drillers to go far deeper than they ever did before, sometimes a mile or two below the surface, to areas called shale plays. You might have heard of the Marcellus Shale, the Barnett Shale, or the Bakken Shale field in spread across the United States. And the fracking technique involves pumping millions of gallons of water, sand to prop up the cracks that the water creates, and undisclosed chemicals down below the surface to pump out new sources of natural gas. So these fracked wells bring up natural gas to the surface, and fracking is has spread widely across the United States in the last two or three years, and it's created dramatic changes for America and its energy use. Most of it good. Natural gas is better than coal. It burns cleaner, generally. It has provided a lot of wealth for landowners who have provided the leases to the industry. It's created jobs. And you'll see a lot of advertising, or hear it on television and radio and print, touting the dramatic success of fracking. And I don't deny that. But fracking brings with it lots of risk that I don't believe the industry really addresses, or that Americans are really aware of. The threat that fracking could poison the water that we drink, because the pipes that they use have to be drilled through the aquifer. And as the technique of fracking brings natural gas to the surface, it also stands the chance that it could poison our drinking water supplies. Fracking also brings up a lot of methane that has to be captured at the well surface and oftentimes is not. So that has consequences for global warming. And another aspect of fracking that I address in the book is the fact that a lot of that water that goes down the pipe comes back up, as much as 30% of it. And it needs, it's a saline spent water. It has those chemicals that it went down with, plus new ones that it captured in the shale layer. And the industry has to find some place to put that water. They can't process it through water recycling plants, so they have to truck it off to different sites for disposal. And that frack water has a lot of consequences. If they put it into big borrow pits or ponds, it can evaporate into the atmosphere. The trucks can and have crashed. And the other interesting wrinkle is that, for example, in Pennsylvania, the trucks carrying frack water from Pennsylvania to Ohio pumped that spent water, frack water, down the Ohio wells, and guess what? It causes earthquakes. It's been proven by scientists that the disposal of frack water causes man-made earthquakes.
We're speaking with Larry Budmeier on The Book Report.
A number of studies have now come out that have raised questions. One from the University of Colorado recently showed that families living near fracked wells have a 30% higher chance that there would be birth defects in children born nearby.
And is Washington doing any kind of oversight?
This is a classic case of states' rights trumping federal government. It turns out that fracking is regulated by states. So as fracking has moved from state to state, it falls to the legislatures to come up with the practices, the regulations, and reforms.
You've done a great job of presenting the science, but without stopping the storyline. It is kind of an adventure thriller. How did you master that technique?
Well, thanks for the compliment. I wanted to make sure that the story was a good, quick, fast read. I wanted to infuse the storyline with humor. I wanted to make Rappahannock County, Virginia, where the story is set, a star. I wanted to make it an actual character. So it's a cautionary tale.
Right.
And I wanted to invent characters that will move with me through a whole series of environmental novels set in Rappahannock County, with each new environmental threat bringing Tip Tyler and his friends and family back into the effort to beat back the environmental threat.
Well, I have to tell the readers that I love Tip, and I'm very glad he'll be back with more adventures. Larry Budd, thank you so much for joining us today.
Elaine, thank you, and I really admire the show and hope that you attract new listeners week after week.
All right. I love the book.
Okay.
All righty. Bye now.
Bye.
World Made by Hand is a compelling work of speculative fiction. Celebrated social commentator James Howard Kunstler brings to life what America might be a few decades hence in a world where devastating catastrophes have converged. The electricity has flickered out. The automobile age is over. In Union Grove, a little town in upstate New York, the future is nothing like people thought it would be. Life is hard and close to the bone. Transportation is slow and dangerous. Food is grown locally at great expense of time and energy, and the outside world is largely unknown. There may be a president, and he might be in Minneapolis now, but people aren't sure. The townspeople's challenges play out in a fully realized world of abandoned highways and empty houses, horses working the fields and rivers no longer polluted and replenished with fish. This is the surprising story of Robert Earle and his fellow townspeople and what happens to them one summer in a country that has changed profoundly. Jim Meskimen narrates.
What do you do with the dirty water?
Into the river, he said. It's got soap in it. It's just gray water. It'll go downstream to the Hudson. That's not right. It's below where we fish, and mostly from town. It's just soapy water. That's a hell of an attitude. Don't get all environmental with me, he said. I wouldn't dump soapy water in the river. It wouldn't affect anything. I wouldn't be so sure. You're being an nice talk, Reverend. I've been thinking about this for a long time. Maybe you should think about it longer. Condescending vulgarian. Nabob of negativism. I let him have the last word. It was always better that way with Lauren. He could keep it up forever. We walked a ways more, enjoying the silence and the fireflies. Nabob of negativism? I said. Where'd you get that one? Spiro T. Agnew. Who was he? Vice President under Nixon. Oh? I don't remember Nixon too well. Agnew used to call news reporters nattering nabobs of negativism. He wouldn't be able to say that nowadays, would he? No, he'd have to call them nabobs of nothingness, Lauren said and laughed at his own joke. I guess I didn't think it was that funny, since we didn't have news reporters anymore, and you barely knew what was going on 5 miles away. Hey, look, he said, give this laundry idea a chance. It would be good for the community. Try not to be negative. I'm not negative. Contrary, then. I'm not contrary. You should hear yourself. Eventually, the train tracks crossed over Lovell Road, and we got off them there while the road took us across the river on a steel and concrete bridge that was falling to pieces now. It had been years since the state of New York repaired any of these things. There were big holes in the deck you could see clear through. Another couple of spring floods and it might be swept away altogether. On the far bank stood an old hydroelectric station, or the brick shell of one. An inscription in the masonry lintel over the door said it was built in 1919. The big power company Niagara Mohawk closed down all these little generating plants in the 1960s because they were supposedly inefficient. Nothing was left but the walls and part of the roof. The turbines and metal parts had long since been sold for scrap, and every other useful thing was scavenged out. We couldn't replace them anymore. It was too bad because it might have lit up our whole town. Anyway, the little dam there had been breached, and rebuilding that would have been more than our community could manage. I don't know if anybody would even have known how to do it. It was chilling to reflect on how well the world used to work, and how much we'd lost. We stopped halfway across the bridge in the lovely pink light that remained of the long June day, and peered down to the water. Scores of big trout finned in the current beside the crumbling bridge abutment. A nice hatch of cream-colored mayflies fluttered off the water and mingled with the fireflies. The swift little mud swallows that nested under the bridge did an aerial ballet through it, gorging themselves. Plenty of mayflies would still get away for their one ecstatic night of reproducing in the treetops. They would return to the river to die the next morning. It was called the Spinner Fall. They'd been doing it for millions of years before we showed up. "Want to go down and try some?" I said. "My creel is full," Lauren said. "We could put back what we catch." "I've fished enough tonight, Robert." "Okay, let's go home." It was about a 3-mile walk back to Union Grove. In the old days, you'd drive it, of course, but now you walked. I didn't mind. I enjoyed the peacefulness and easy pace of the walk. In a car, I remembered, you generally noticed only what was in your head or on the radio, while the landscape itself seemed dead, or at least irrelevant. Walking, it was impossible to not pay attention. On a mild, luminous evening like this, the landscape came alive. The crickets had started up. In the distance, a last glimmer of sun caught the top of Pumpkin Hill, where men were still out mowing the first hay crop on the Deaver farm.
That was World Made by Hand by James Howard Kunstler. Finding Everett Ruiz by David Roberts is the definitive biography of the artist, writer, and eloquent celebrator of wilderness, whose bold solo explorations of the American West and mysterious disappearance in the Utah desert at age 20 have earned him a large and devoted cult following. Quote, "I have not tired of the wilderness. Rather, I enjoy its beauty and the vagrant life I lead more keenly all the time. I prefer the saddle to the streetcar and the star-sprinkled sky to a roof, the obscure and difficult trail leading to the unknown, to any paved highway, and the deep peace of the wild to the discontent bred by cities." So Ruiz wrote in his last letter to his brother. Wandering alone with burros and pack horses through California and the Southwest for 5 years in the early 1930s, Ruiz became friends with photographers Edward Weston and Dorothea Lange, swapped prints with Ansel Adams, took part in a Hopi ceremony, learned to speak Navajo, and was among the first outsiders to venture deeply into what was then, and to some extent still is, a little-known wilderness. When he vanished without a trace in November 1934, Ruiz left behind thousands of pages of journals, letters, poems, as well as more than 100 watercolor paintings and block print engravings. A Ruiz mystique, initiated by his parents, but soon enlarged by readers and critics who, struck by his remarkable connection to the wild, likened him to a fledgling John Muir. Today, the Ruiz cult has more adherents, more passionate ones, than at any other time in the 7+ decades since his disappearance. Everett Ruiz is hailed as the paragon of solo exploration, while the mystery of his death remains one of the greatest riddles in the annals of American adventure. Arthur Morey narrates.
The title of this book carries a deliberate double meaning. Since 1998, when I first visited the Escalante country in a concerted effort to see if there was anything new that could be learned about the fate of Everett Ruiz, I have cherished the hope that the passionate wilderness wanderer who disappeared so enigmatically in 1934, at the age of 20, might actually be found. Or if the remains of his body could not be discovered, that enough clues could be ferreted out of the desert and the canyons so that we might be able to determine just how and where the young man met his untimely end. I was hardly alone in that quest. During the more than 7 decades that have elapsed since Everett vanished, all kinds of dedicated sleuths, and not a few mystical wackos, have made it a personal goal to solve the riddle of the vagabond's disappearance. The cult of Everett Ruiz, which has steadily grown over the years, centers on that riddle. Every devotee who responds to the romantic intensity of Everett's writing, or the visionary rapture of his paintings and block prints, wants to know what happened to him after he headed into Davis Gulch in November 1934. Yet at the same time, steeping myself in the writings and artwork served another purpose, which was to find Everett Ruiz in the maze of his moods and contradictions. What made him tick? What was he ultimately after? Why did he need such unrelenting solo adventures in the wilderness to test himself? And if he had a goal beyond endless wandering, how close did he come to fulfilling it? Then, for more than a year, between the summer of 2008 and the autumn of 2009, along with a small group of friends and associates in southeastern Utah, I thought that we might have actually found Everett's body, wedged awkwardly inside a rock crevice in the sandstone monocline of the Comb Ridge.
That was Finding Everett Ruiz by David Roberts. For most of us, traveling means visiting the beautiful places on Earth. Paris, the Taj Mahal, the Grand Canyon. It's rare to book a plane ticket to visit the lifeless moonscape of Canada's oil sand strip mines, or to seek out the Chinese city of Linfen, legendary as the most polluted in the world. But in Visit Sunny Chernobyl, Andrew Blackwell embraces a different kind of travel, taking a jaunt through the most gruesomely polluted places on Earth. From the hidden bars and convenience stores of radioactive wilderness to the sacred but reeking waters of India, Visit Sunny Chernobyl fuses immersive first-person reporting with satire and analysis, making the case that it's time to start appreciating our planet as it is, not as we wish it would be. Irreverent and reflective, the book is a love letter to our biosphere's most tainted, most degraded ecosystems, and a measured consideration of what they mean for us. Axe Norman performs the book that is equal part travelogue, exposé, and environmental memoir.
It turns out there is no better way to learn a few useful words of Chinese than by taking part in a little child labor. In addition to bu yao, I learned yao, meaning want, and hao lei, meaning done, roughly. Like this, Lang and I establish a system of communication, and I began to learn which bits of plastic were worth the prying and which weren't. Some, I believe, had metal inside them, and so were no good for melting down. Over the course of several hours, Lang's excitement at getting to boss around an adult veered into delight at what was becoming an effective collaboration. Soon, when he would go to get a smoke for his uncle, he would get one for me as well, leaving me with a lit cigarette in my mouth before I could even think of saying booyow. The smoke stung my eyes as I worked, making me glad that we were not baking circuit boards instead. That task was done in the covered entry space between the workshop and the street, and was a job the Hans didn't do themselves. They reserved it for their lone employee, who sat in front of a hot plate that held a shimmering pool of molten solder. With a pair of needle-nose pliers, he would pick up a circuit board and float it to the silvery pool of solder. As the solder holding the components on the board melted, acrid fumes rose into a homemade fume hood, which drew them into a chimney and vented them onto the street. This is why the streets of Guiyu smell of cooking circuits. Nearly every building has one of these smokestacks. After frying for 15 or 20 seconds, the circuit board's connections would melt. The worker would pick up the board with his pliers, invert it, and smack it violently on a hunk of concrete to the right of the stove. The components would fly off, along with a spatter of tin and lead, depending on the solder, and go tumbling into an ever-growing pile. He would then toss the board into a heap of newly naked circuit boards. There was gold in those boards. Printed circuit boards use copper for their circuits, but the copper must be protected from corrosion by some kind of coating or plating, often in the form of a microscopically thin layer of alloyed gold. It takes a lot of circuit boards to accumulate a significant amount of gold, but a lot of circuit boards is exactly what Guiyu has. Once Mr. Han had accumulated a sufficient batch, he would give the boards to a contractor to extract the gold. This was the dirtiest part of the entire process. I had heard tales of acid baths and toxic bonfires. Naturally, I wanted to see it for myself. "Don't," said Mr. Han. "Don't try to find those people. They operate illegally, and they're very suspicious. You could get in trouble. Please don't try to find them." Not that I had time, anyway. I was focused on my work, on improving my turnaround time for each motherboard. Brand names cowered under my crowbar. Intel, Acer, Foxconn, Pentium, Philips, Vertex, Blitzen. Each time I had a CPU to unplug from a board, Lang would hold up the collection bucket for me, and I would shoot a three-pointer, and he would smile like we had won the championship. A drag on my cigarette, and I'd pull over another board to wreck out the plastic, pausing to point when I wasn't sure. "Yao?" I would ask. "Boo yao!" Lang would scream. "Boo yao!" I would scream back. And then, if I thought I was done, I would ask, "How lay?" "How lay?" Lang would say, sounding almost philosophical. Then, with a look of what I hoped was respect, or at least camaraderie, he'd pause his helper dogs and slide another board in front of me. The little slave driver. A storefront with a small glass case full of integrated circuits. It was a tiny shop, one room, run by two young brothers. 3 feet behind the display case was a bunk bed. They lived in the shop. To the left was a table arrayed with 100 small cups for sorting their wares. One brother, wearing a red pleather jacket and a striped button-down shirt, watched with cautious amusement as I took pictures of his display case. I wanted to buy a small baggie of chips as a souvenir. He was confused. What did I want it for? The kind of chip I would buy depended on the intended use. When he finally understood, he refused to let me buy one, insisting that I accept it as a gift. On a busy market street, a nail salon with 6 young women in black tights and high-heel boots. All the young or youngish women in Guiyu dressed this way. They chattered as they bent over their work. It was, of course, not a nail salon, but a circuit shop. Each woman held a handful of chips. Using tweezers, they would pick up a single chip and dip each of its 2 rows of contacts into a pool of molten solder on a shared hot plate. Working with the speed and economy of motion that comes from day upon day of precise repetition.
That was Visit Sunny Chernobyl and Other Adventures in the World's Most Polluted Places by Andrew Blackwell. The Book Report offers up a classic for our last selection today. In June of 1869, John Muir reluctantly accepted a job herding sheep from the Central Valley of California to the headwaters of the Merced River, high into the Sierra Nevadas and deep into Yosemite. He felt ill-equipped for his work, and yet the opportunity thrilled his adventurous spirit. With a notebook tied to his belt, he set out for a summer he would never forget. My First Summer in the Sierra is Muir's classic account of that extraordinary journey. The book was not published until 1911, by which time he had become celebrated for his work as a naturalist and conservationist. 100 years later, we can still experience Muir's transcendent joy as he climbed the mountains, explored the lakes and the streams, and studied the region's flowers and trees. Brett Barry performs the book.
Carlo knew we were talking about him, watched our faces, and listened so attentively that I fancied he understood us. Calling him by name, I asked him if he was willing to go with me. He looked me in the face with eyes expressing wonderful intelligence, then turned to his master, and after permission was given by a wave of the hand toward me and a farewell patting caress, he quietly followed me, as if he perfectly understood all that had been said and had known me always. June 3, 1869. This morning, provisions, camp kettles, blankets, plant press, etc., were packed on two horses. The flock headed for the tawny foothills, and away we sauntered in a cloud of dust. Mr. Delaney, bony and tall, with sharply hacked profile like Don Quixote, leading the pack horses, Billy, the proud shepherd, a Chinaman, and a Digger Indian to assist in driving for the first few days in the brushy foothills, and myself, with notebook tied to my belt. The home ranch from which we set out is on the south side of the Tuolumne River, near French Bar, where the foothills of metamorphic gold-bearing slates dip below the stratified deposits of the Central Valley. We had not gone more than a mile before some of the old leaders of the flock showed by the eager, inquiring way they ran and looked ahead that they were thinking of the high pastures they had enjoyed last summer. Soon the whole flock seemed to be hopefully excited, the mothers calling their lambs, the lambs replying in tones wonderfully human, their fondly quavering calls interrupted now and then by hastily snatched mouthfuls of withered grass. Amid all this seeming babble of baas as they streamed over the hills, every mother and child recognized each other's voice. In case a tired lamb, half asleep in the smothering dust, should fail to answer, its mother would come running back through the flock toward the spot whence its last response was heard, and refused to be comforted until she found it. The one of a thousand, though to our eyes and ears all seemed alike. The flock traveled at the rate of about a mile an hour, outspread in the form of an irregular triangle, about 100 yards wide at the base and 150 yards long, with a crooked, ever-changing point made up of the strongest foragers called the leaders, which, with the most active of those scattered along the ragged sides of the main body, hastily explored nooks in the rocks and bushes for grass and leaves. The lambs and feeble old mothers dawdling in the rear were called the tail end. About noon, the heat was hard to bear. The poor sheep panted pitifully and tried to stop in the shade of every tree they came to, while we gazed with eager longing through the dim, burning glare toward the snowy mountains and streams, though not one was in sight. The landscape is only wavering foothills, roughened here and there with bushes and trees and outcropping masses of slate. The trees, mostly the blue oak, Quercus de Glacii, are about 30 to 40 feet high, with pale blue-green leaves and white bark, sparsely planted on the thinnest soil or in crevices of rocks, beyond the reach of grass fires. The slates in many places rise abruptly through the tawny grass in sharp, lichen-covered slabs, like tombstones in deserted burying grounds. With the exception of the oak and four or five species of manzanita and ceanothus, the vegetation of the foothills is mostly the same as that of the plains. I saw this region in the early spring when it was a charming landscape garden full of birds and bees and flowers. Now the scorching weather makes everything dreary. The ground is full of cracks. Lizards glide about on the rocks, and ants in amazing numbers, whose tiny sparks of life only burn the brighter with the heat, fairly quiver with unquenchable energy as they run in long lines to fight and gather food. How it comes that they do not dry to a crisp in a few seconds' exposure to such sunfire is marvelous. A few rattlesnakes lie coiled in out-of-the-way places, but are seldom seen. Magpies and crows, usually so noisy, are silent now, standing in mixed flocks on the ground beneath the best shade trees, with bills wide open and wings drooped, too breathless to speak.
We've just heard My First Summer in the Sierra by John Muir. Readers, we've covered some diverse titles today, all of which I hope you found thought-provoking. With smart investments in sustainable technology, forward-thinking public policy and an educated public, we can work towards transforming our cities and forging a sustainable future. For more titles with impact, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for joining me in this salute to Earth Day 2014. Please join me again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.